Hello, this is Cameron Kuhn and Bob Dobbs with episode number 51 of our ongoing series of analyzing McLuhan's drama of cognition, perhaps. We're now at page 101 of my small book on what we didn't know about Trump. And there's a quote at the top, and it says, and this is from a very rare, valuable interview in something called Forces Magazine, put out by Hydro-Québec. And this was issue number 22 in 1973. So McLuhan is saying, quote, "The new art form of our time is the media themselves. Not painting, not movies, not drama, but the media themselves have become the new art forms." Then there's dot, dot, dot. "I write cartoons, dot, dot, dot. I have wanted to write a play for a long time on the media, and the media themselves are the avant-garde area of our society. Avant-garde no longer exists in painting and music and poetry. It's in the media themselves, not in the programs. Avant-garde is not in hockey, not in baseball, or any of these entertainments. It's in the media themselves." Now, around that time, there was a rock critic named Richard Meltzer. He was almost the first one. And he put out a book called The Aesthetics of Rock in 1970. And he was totally fed up with the industry. He liked the mid-60s, sort of the late 60s. But by 1970, he did this book. And he was a graduate of Yale. And then he dropped out of rock journalism. And he started following wrestling. What back then would be silly stuff, you know, just hanging out with the people or something. And anti-intellectual. So I always remembered that. So when McLuhan says in 1973, pretty well around the same time as Meltzer's crack-up, he's saying the avant-garde is not in hockey, not in baseball. Who the hell thought that the avant-garde was in hockey? Nobody thought that was the avant-garde, okay? They thought it was John Cage and Fluxus and the artists down in New York City and maybe in Europe. But some postmodern people like Meltzer was onto that, and he picked not hockey but wrestling. So I always remembered that, but I always thought that was pretty savvy of McLuhan. He kind of knew that this weird attempt to maintain a mind, apply the mind to something after the disillusionment of the 60s. And so you had Meltzer, you know, studying wrestling. McLuhan, it seems to me, picked up on that. By saying, you know, of course, the traditional cultural New York stuff is not the avant-garde. You're not going to get that in New York. You got to go out and watch wrestling. He almost says that, but he goes a step further and says the media themselves. And then people say, oh, you mean the content, the Pro T Columbo and 60 Minutes or something? No, not in the programs. This is really an important distinction, that the form of the media alters society like people thought art would do. And art, apparently, in the 18th and 19th century, had a big impact on the urban populations. They'd go to a new concert or a new opera or a new painting gallery demonstration of somebody's work, and people would get all involved in it. At least it was reported to us they did, right? There was much discussion and gnashing of teeth over whether this art was good enough for the Royal Academy or not. But all that world no longer was anti-environmental anymore in the 20th century. So it becomes the effect of changing society that art was pretending to do, and maybe doing a little bit, was taken over by first the printing press and then the electric media. So you then come up with McLuhan's statement somewheres that he says Canada is the present anti-environment. So what was the artist of the 60s? It wasn't Picasso, Frank Zappa, or somebody, Warhol. It was Canada. Canada as a corporate entity was an appropriate anti-environment to the American global theater that it was making. So that point I'm making about Canada as... In other words, McLuhan is not looking for art from John Cage. He's looking at environments, and maybe he is the Canada, anthropomorphically, that he's talking about. But that's quite a statement to say that a country is an anti-environment. Is the avant-garde, or is the protection. So that's why this quote is so important to get that. I don't think anybody got that ever, at least no one I ever encountered. No one even knew what I was talking about. That this is one of my favorite quotes, that the media is the environment and is the artist. Then that gets into the AirSats and the anti-environment's a rapid series of innovations, and then it gets into the global theater and then the global membrane, the stuff I'm trying to lay out, and then the Android meme. So, right. You know, once you get into the Android meme, that is the new artist. So the art world itself in New York City, painting, music, poetry, but especially painting, it just gets raped by Wall Street every 5 years, right? The guys have a boom. They need to put their money somewhere, so they go to the art schools and hijack some students and put them up for a couple of weeks as the next new artist. Mm-hmm. And so many art critics of the Village Voice in different places that I would read, they all quit. Art had become, you know, a ghetto. It was not serving the anti-environmental role that they thought it was had been doing, but they did not know the important point McLuhan was saying, that the media environments were the anti-environments. See, to get that makes you understand that McLuhan knew something other people didn't. Nobody else knew, not even John Cage and the artist that romanticized McLuhan or made a big deal out of him. What do you think of that little dissertation? You agree with everything I say?
Not everything, no.
You don't?
I agree with the gist, but I would say that if we want to understand what you were just saying, we have to realize that most of the stuff you were saying were not statements, that was questions.
Yeah.
So, for example, if we say that Canada is the anti-environment and something like Canada is the artist, it's not as if we know just what Canada was, and it's not as if we know how Canada could function as an artist or as the artist. Those are questions, right? There's something, if we want to understand what human beings are, we need to understand what they're subject to. And what they're subject to is something like the art form of media. But that's a question. That's not a statement, as if we pick up a paper and we say, this is what human beings are all about, waving the paper around or waving a cassette around or something like that. It's an appeal for research into things that we think are obvious but turn out not to be.
Yeah, so titles like Cultures Are Business, they become popular themes by the 90s. There was this guy named Frank. Frank was his last name, who wrote a book saying all of the independent rock groups, or Kurt Cobain and the guys trying not to be compromised, they all get compromised. The media, the big corporations swallow up anything that tries to be art or against the flow.
Right. So it wasn't just painting that was subject to that process. It was music. It was especially films. It was any kind of writing whatsoever was commercialized, not in the banal sense of being, subject to a certain title pull of the corporations, commercialized in the sense of subject to a certain understanding of world that was groundless.
Yeah, I like to say the Gutenberg arts, or all analog media, was the content of the digital Android meme. So, music, painting, film, poetry, even television.
Right.
Were the content.
Yeah. I think that's an important statement you just made. Probably a really important one for understanding your pamphlet.
Yeah.
When you say that the artist was the Android meme, you certainly don't mean something like there's some place or some time when we could understand the Android meme as a certain kind of person or a certain kind of thing or
right.
a certain force or something. I think what you're saying is that there's something going on that can only be understood by contemplating something like the Android meme, but what the Android meme is a question that more or less falls through itself in its complexity.
Yeah.
And that we have to stick with it in order to understand not only what it is through an action that's going on around us, but in order to understand in the first place how we would ever investigate a question like that.
Right, so that Baudrillard simulation or the Matrix, these things don't make it. That's not what the Android meme is. There are subplots of it, but what you're saying is the complexity of analyzing it, it's like analyzing Finney's Wake. Finney's Wake is the closest to presenting the Android meme in book form, in an obsolete medium. So the problems that people have wrestling with Finney's Wake are a rehearsal of wrestling with the Android meme.
I can buy that.
Yeah. So, you know, you have culture is our business. What, you know, some college student, okay, what's he saying? Culture is our business? No, we don't like business. That's capitalism. We're socialists. We're radicals. We're bohemians. We're not materialists. We do yoga. This, since the 90s, the cliche North American young person who's trying to be intelligent or get somewhere is with their intelligence, they might find, well, that's odd. Culture's our business. No, culture is really beyond business. But to understand how accurate that statement is, culture is our business, is
right.
what you're saying, getting close to understanding the Android meme, how that anticipates that. And so McLuhan was talking back then in the late 60s on the level that nobody believed. And occasionally he would make fun of culture, like how the CRTC, controlling Canadian content in the radio, Canadian radio. And McLuhan would say, well, the user is the content. If you have somebody from Poland watching Canadian TV, it's Polish TV. You know what I mean? He had great ways to talk about it, interesting little quirks or absurdities, to show that he was pointing to something that nobody was getting.
Right.
But this. Go ahead.
Well, what I'd like to do is just think about culture is our business for a short time. First off, Culture is Our Business was a book published, in 1970?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Yeah.
But the phrase itself was much earlier.
Yeah.
I think already in the 1950s he used the phrase.
Yes.
And he had an essay at some point called Culture is Our Business. But when we think about it, culture is our business is not something that's obvious in the sense of saying, well, culture is subject to business in the sense that we were just talking about, where everything becomes commercialized.
Yeah, commodification, they called it.
That's right. So then culture is our business can be taken to mean the real thing that we have to think about, that is to say the real business of our lives in a non-commercial sense, is to try to figure out what culture is. culture is something that is transpersonal, and it its movement through history is what shapes how people see and how they feel, but we don't know anything about what culture is. So we propagate it, but we do so unconsciously and without understanding its effects. So the real business that we have to get down to is figuring out what culture is. Or another whole meaning is that culture is our business can be taken to mean whenever we do anything, whenever we go about our business and daily lives, culture is already implicated in it, but we don't know that.
Yeah.
So culture is our business. Culture is what we are always already doing, but we have no idea that we're doing it.
Yeah.
So
and we misplace our values or where values can be applied. So culture is our business means more and more participation by everybody in media coverage. So that by the 90s, people are saying the culture is getting dumber and dumber. And I say, no. All aspects of culture, as you were just saying, everything we do is becoming the content. And not all of it is pretty or, you know, high sophisticated. It's what he was actually saying in the 50s. The whole planet, all the nations and cultures and media become the content of this ongoing process.
Right.
And
so imagine that culture is something like a language. And then somebody comes along and they say, well, vowels are good, but consonants are bad. Right? Or the first part of the alphabet is pretty, but when you get down around KLM, it's not pretty anymore, right?
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah,
So what McLuhan is saying is the most important aspects of human life are completely unconscious to us.
Yeah.
And so we actually exist in a kind of fog that is, it determines everything, and we know nothing about it.
Yeah.
And we think that we have identities, we think we have conceptions and perceptions and all this sort of stuff, and it's all bullshit.
Right.
So wrestling tells us who we are.
Yeah, because as scandals became more and more the content of the news, scandals everywhere, and more and more outrageous scandals the last 30 years, but nobody seems to get caught, or nobody really puts their foot down and says, we definitely got to turn off TV. This is just wiping us out. We're just so corrupt. Because news was the wealth-making engine, and scandals made wealth. It made movies. It made books, magazine stories, right? So you had to have humans screwing up. That was the new culture. That was the wealth-making content in a world where there was no possibility of wealth anymore, technically on the media formal level, because everybody shared the same discarded space, which we weren't even aware of what that was or even how to describe it. So all human activity becomes the content, and so you can see people getting more and more disgusted with their lives and with society because of what the media is showing, not knowing that the media could use everything to make wealth.
Right. So people are disgusted, and they think that they can identify where the disgust arises.
Yeah.
But they can't. They have no idea why things are becoming disgusting. No idea at all. And that's why the processes are only snowballing into today.
Yes.
People are desperately looking for a break. Brake, but they have no idea where to find it.
Yeah.
So when you talk about the scandals never being resolved, the mechanism there is the scandal is a breaking of rules, moral rules or aesthetic rules or something. But of course, those rules are groundless. So the way the news functions is to say, oh, these terrible things have happened. They've broken these rules. But of course that can't be resolved because those rules are hanging in the air. They're groundless. They're non-existent. And so you have to move on to the next scandal. So you implicate the rules, and then when the rug gets pulled out from underneath the rules, then you move on to the next scandal.
Yep.
Where rules can be again implicated.
And the whole society is engaged in making the word that makes the market, and the word is scandal.
Yeah.
Endless insult. Like you take Tucker Carlson, if you listen to him for a while, every night he finds some outrageous thing, and he calls everybody an idiot, and all the esteemed members of politics and everything, they're all doofuses. He really calls out people, really insults them. And but he does this every day. And he's been doing it for years. What kind of job is that? He can't stop it. He's outraged. We got to do something about this. We got to find out why this is happening. But he's never going to actually let me on there and explain to him what's going on, right? He's not going to let perception come in. So the whole everybody, CNN, all the stations, endless outrage. And the ultimate paradox was the media said, "Here comes Trump. Oh man, we can make a lot of money off this guy," and they pushed it to extreme, and he ended up being president. And then, okay, well, he's president, we continue making a lot of money, and they made up all these hoaxes and scandals. And then Biden comes in, and apparently the news starts to complain. Well, we need more lively scandals. We need to get Trump back in to get the scandal quotient up. So Trump exposed this process we're trying to get at, you and I, talking about. He was an unwitting, I would say he was the greatest artist of the last 30, 40 years. If you take an artist as someone who makes a big impact, you could even say a general, you know, an Eisenhower or somebody that accomplishes a major change in direction of what things going. Trump is still doing that. So no, Philip Glass never got anywhere with Einstein on the beach. Or Zappa never became president, and just all these other great artists in the culture of Time magazine world, the endless celebrity world, none of them creates a change. Trump caused a change. He, in the sense that he made somebody feel threatened. He was going into the deep state, and like the deep scandal. He was actually going to get to the scandal of all scandals, and they're still impeaching him the third time for doing that. Disguised as some kind of disruption on January 6th. So if I'm dealing with a somnambulist, I'll bring this up. I don't have too much opportunity usually to meet a somnambulist because I don't have that kind of social life. But if I have a chance, I'll point this out. Yeah, you find Trump disgusting or you find Trump fantastic. No, Trump is the first guy to actually change society in 50 years. And he is the tech body, which is a later stage of the Android meme. And that's what my book is trying to get to, how Trump is the tech body. And that's a difficult thing to get to because we're just still back at global village becoming global theater. But in the theater, the media become the art forms. And when you know that, you're not going to be running out to galleries or to movies or to any cultural stuff that creates wealth, traditional, you know, visual space money wealth, because it's none of it is as important as the medium itself.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's right. When you know that's what's causing everything, that's the engine, you're not going to be impressed with Michael Ondaatje's latest novel or who's someone you got there in Canada? The husband of Adrian Clarkson, you know, Saul somebody or something.
Black, isn't it? Oh, I'm sorry. I was thinking of somebody
not
else.
He's a commentator. You know, he gets his chance. He gets to pontificate every now and then on CBC or something. I understand. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen it in 30 years, but I remember that stuff when I was in Toronto.
Yeah.
But
so let's not go too fast here because there's a lot of interesting stuff in what you're saying.
Good.
One thing is in the quote from Forces magazine. Notice how I don't know if McLuhan misspoke or if there was a problem with translation or whatever, but he starts off by saying the new art form, which is a singular, the new art form, and then he ends up in the same sentence talking about the new art forms, plural.
Yeah.
And sometimes when you're talking, you use the singular, and sometimes you use the plural. And I think it's really important that people understand it in the singular. Usually I like to pluralize things, but here, where he's talking about the new art form, he's saying not the movies, not drama, not media, not media in the sense of paper or radio or TV or something. So he's saying the new art form envelops or develops or comes out of or is the ground of all of these things. And so he's raising the question of, well, what is an art form if it's not this one, not that one, not,
yeah,
you know, on
what is
and
the
on.
Word media referring to?
Correct, correct. And so then when you say that Trump is the artist that has most influenced our whatever, what can you say, our consciousness of ourselves,
yeah,
or has raised the question of our anti-environment in a way that no other artist has been able to do. I think those are really interesting statements that you're making there.
Good.
But the big question is, how does the word is function?
Because
I remember when...
The new art form is all the media together, you know, a little propaganda idea.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so it can go. It can be singular, plural. The new art form is all the media themselves. And then he names media, and they are not the art forms.
Correct.
It's the whole thing, collectivity. The global theater massage is the media singular. But it's made up of everything that were analog media. And uh-huh, it is the anti-environment, because the ground, there is no content in the ground. It's invisible. It's I don't know, ineffable, intangible. It's the ground, and that's electricity. So
now, you don't want to say intangible, I don't think, because it's tactile in the proper sense. And so it can't be intangible, which means not tactile, right?
Right. But it's interesting how Barry Marshall used the word intangibles in Take Today. They use it several times. The intangibles are this or that, or the intangibles are what we can experience, but tangibility we can't find. They play with it. So sometimes I'll put an intangible to indicate tactility. Because tactility is not a sense.
No, that makes good sense to me.
All right.
Yeah.
Good.
But doesn't that get down to this whole question of is? And I don't mean to raise it in the sense that Bill Clinton did. but when you say that Trump is something,
yeah,
or the new art form is, I think what you're doing is you are indicating a difficulty and a question implicated in is,
yep,
implicated in how being operates in a human being, but also in the being of the world, or
yep,
the being of language or whatever. And that kind of transitivity of being is a very difficult but interesting question.
Yeah, didn't McLuhan do a tetrad on is?
Isn't that, I don't know. Maybe.
What would he have called it? It might be in Laws of Media or the Global Village.
Yeah.
Is there another word for is? What is it called?
Well, that's a great question.
Yeah.
That is a great question.
Well, he does verbum, which is interesting. The tetrad on verbum, which is more like a grunt, right? It's before civilized language or language per se. It's like if you imagine early humans, if there were such a state, early humans, cavemen or something, they lived so in such a tactile, involved way that the grunting communicated a lot. They just pointed. They just pushed. They just banged, you know. Very abrupt encounter with matter. That's tactility, the original. And so there was nobody had to make sense of some story, probably before story. Do you know what I mean? They probably did hallucinate that they were making rain or something. The stars were in their eyes, stuff like that. I once said that cavemen, when they died, they didn't know they died. It was so similar to being alive.
Mm-hmm.
That intangible, I think that's intangible. The difference
it's between intangible life. For our thinking, because the tactility or the tangibility is so present that it's something that we no longer understand, because for us that has dissipated.
Yeah.
Right? Heidegger has some notion of this too. People often criticize him for concentrating more and more on the pre-Socratics and saying that there was something going on with the pre-Socratics that gets lost. But I think McLuhan's whole idea of the Gutenberg galaxy comes close to that, because the idea is that when human beings begin to introduce efficiency into their lives, that always comes at a loss. So letters are extremely important in human history, but with all of the advantages that letters bring to intelligibility, there's also a loss.
Yeah.
There, it's a kind of abbreviation of speech. And so then throughout history, the technological developments are always abbreviations. They're ways of saying, well, look, if you just concentrate on this particular feature, then everything becomes easier to understand. Well, yes, it becomes easier to understand or easier to make or easier to sell or whatever, but there is a loss associated with that. There's never pure profit. There's profit and loss always balance out, and Western civilization is the story of forgetting about the losses and just emphasizing the profits, right? And we've now come to the end of that.
Yeah, yeah.
So when McLuhan thinks that we've gone back into caveman society with grunting and stuff, what he's saying is we've come to a point where we have to get back into the kind of tangibility that humans knew in the beginning. That's what human beings are and always will be, but we've come so far away from it that we've lost our ground, we've lost our reality, and we're now going to destroy ourselves if we don't get back to that fundamental tactility, tangibility.
Yeah, so in the earliest periods, the Aboriginal periods, there was no gain or loss.
Right.
There was no difference in experience. It just was
right.
Frequencies or variations or nuances or something. But
mm-hmm.
Once you get into explicitness, is McLuhan's word, you start to spell out some efficient level, like you were describing, then you got something, and therefore you're going to lose something. But if you
yeah.
weren't getting anything, it didn't require or got a sense of getting something, which the tactile existence would be. That's why we have gotten back to that, because nobody gains or loses in this economy. You make a lot of money, you got to give it back. If you have no money, you'll get some. Someone will give you some as welfare. So I think we're in that very early, that early condition of extreme tactility and intangibleness is our existence today. And that's why mm-hmm. everybody is so obsessed with texting or connecting digitally
right.
and having something be outside themselves, even though it's very
correct.
Temporary.
But notice how you say it is our existence, right? So you have a double is there, because existence is
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
So you say it is our existence, but it's an existence in which people are, there's the word is again, an existence in which people are, but they don't know that they're there, and they have no idea about the ground rules of being there, another is and being. So you have an existence in which people are, where they have no idea about what they're doing and where they're headed and what this all means. And so we're dominated by a question that we don't acknowledge. So here's McLuhan kind of beating away, saying, let's acknowledge the question.
Yeah, and he would say the interrogative had taken over life. People were
yeah.
engaging and questioning more and more because the big question was looming over them, but they couldn't
That's
hear
right.
it, so they did a lot
yeah.
of little questions.
You could even say that take today names all those things that we were just talking about, right?
In,
take today means today is in question.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Is there a today?
Correct.
What was it? Yestermorrow is our permanent address.
Yeah.
No, today. It's yestermorrow.
Yeah, but notice that between yester and morrow, there is medium. Right? They yester and morrow get hyphenated in some way. So the medium is the message, names the dynamic of yestermorrow, and the dynamic of yestermorrow is tactility, and tactility is the fog of the present between yestermorrow that we live but don't know.
Right, and so that's why McLuhan said he got around by feeling, like a blind
yeah.
man with his little stick. He'd be tapping
exactly.
things,
yeah.
Find out where he is temporarily, so he could then get to the next part. So all that is in this tremendous quote. And, of course, nobody knew the quote. Nobody read Hydro-Québec. Maybe a couple of executives got it, but we didn't hear from them. They didn't have their minds blown or didn't tell anybody. But if you knew that quote, so how did I find that? Either Barry Nevitt gave it to me, or I found it in the McLuhan archives when I did it in 1980. Yeah, the end of 1980. But it's have you ever seen? Do you have a copy of this magazine, this particular issue?
Yeah, I do.
You know, it's got a big article on Marcuse, and a big article on Galbraith. Is it? I think it's Galbraith and McLuhan, three heavies, and. McLuhan says a lot of interesting things there in there that you don't see otherwise. Like he said, the real art form of the moonshots should have been the NASA headquarters monitoring the pressure measurements of the astronauts in their suits. Do you remember that?
No, I don't, but that's an interesting...
The drama of what their bodies were going through as they were flying to the moon... That's what
right.
he said was the real drama of the show, and they missed it.
But notice that that's what you're talking about of the astronauts in their suits is exactly what we've been talking about in our whole conversation.
Yeah.
The whole conversation of culture is our business has to do with the atmospheric pressure on contemporary society that McLuhan would measure, but nobody is paying any attention to.
Right. And we now are on the edge of a digital, some people think, dictatorship, where everybody may not get a chip, but they will have their smartphone monitoring their bodies because they'll mm-hmm. have become an astronaut to the extreme.
Sure. Yeah, well, this has already happened, of course. This is the this is the future we can see because it's the present.
Yes. So... McLuhan again was describing the drama that was coming, you know, 50 years before. See?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's very impressive because nobody else was even near that. they wouldn't even say those things. They wouldn't understand how relevant they were. They wouldn't know.
Right.
They think it would make them look stupid to talk that way.
So notice the Forces magazine article is 1973.
Yeah.
And he says avant-garde is not in hockey nor in baseball. But in 1953, I think it was, or it could have been 1952 even, he talks about baseball as culture.
Yeah.
Right? He has that CBC piece on baseball as culture. So he was around 1950, was already very conscious of the fact that there's nothing that is not culture.
And he also understood the late state of the human condition, because he was saying, you know, we were 1934, and you couldn't tell people how polluted everything was because, oh, of course, we'll just go to the moon and live there. You remember that quote?
Yeah. That's from a letter to Pound.
Yeah, that kind of talk. Yeah. It was more science fiction than whatever Philip K. Dick and the rest of them were coming up with.
Yeah, so what he was saying in that particular letter is that we don't have to worry about the fact that we're losing our topsoil.
Yeah.
We'll just go and grow everything on the moon.
Right? Yeah, just move down the street.
Yeah. God. The United States and Canada have ridiculous environmental laws about plastics, let's say, or about medicines, where what we say is we'll approve anything, and then if there's some problem in the future, then we'll fix it then.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
So if you introduce problems that either can't be fixed or impoverish you or kill everybody in order to fix them, right? So this is another instance of how we have to get back into the caveman mentality, because they weren't interested in efficiencies, right? They are living in a present that is satisfactory and it does not have efficient abbreviations because they don't make sense. And that is where we need to go by having been, but we don't know that. It's, you know, we're maybe that's what dark matter is, or the unknown need.
It's what CERN is discovering.
maybe.
Yeah, and yeah. It's scaring them. They shut down every now and then. They do a little media fast. So let's back off. This is getting strange.
Right. Well, the machine always needs to be updated.
Yeah.
The machine is the ultimate tomorrow, but it's always out of date.
So CERN is not the avant-garde. The tech body is the avant-garde, the new McLuhan would say. Yeah. So... And remember, he says he writes cartoons, which are bounding lines, generalities. Eric once said, we specialize in generalisms. So general outlines are cartoons, right?
Yeah.
Don't waste time on the details. So it's when you look at hot and cold, these two terms and the two shapes, two different environments, he is writing cartoons, just like people didn't recognize what Phineas Wake was. Nobody knew that McLuhan, when he presented himself in a book form, that was a cartoon that he was writing. And he actually described Mechanical Bride as a new kind of science fiction, where the ads and the comics were the content. Isn't that what he said to his mother? They were the characters, the ads and the comics themselves. That's the media as the drama. They're the people. That's post-people. That's post-anthropomorphic. That's post-human.
Correct. And note, all of his books raise the question of, you know, what is the text and what is the quotation? Especially in Gutenberg Galaxy, for example, where he got the award for Canadian writing. About half the book isn't his writing.
That's right.
And lots of Gutenberg Galaxy, it's very, very hard to understand if it's McLuhan or somebody else. And not, it's not only hard to understand because the writing goes seamlessly from McLuhan to somebody else, but also the way the book is set up. The book is set up so that sometimes it's very clear about what's a quotation and what isn't, but other times that distinction is blurred.
Right.
And
you,
so,
no, I get ahead. An important point there. In Exploration, I think number 5, radio versus TV, you know,
yeah,
that
the
article.
Absent-minded. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, if that's the one, though it might be media or sports or something, do you have your, sitting there on the shelf, your explorations?
No, no.
Okay, well, go to 5 or 6 and get the main McLuhan essay, and he's writing at the end, he's making a statement, and it merges into a section of Finnegan's Wake. There's no difference, no punctuation. And I pointed this out to Eric, and I said, he intended that. In other words, he was writing Finnegan's Wake. And so he merged it with actual Finnegan's Wake at the very end. He said, oh, no, no, that's a mistake. That's, you know, editorial mistake. He didn't get it. And you just confirmed it by your noticing him doing that in other places.
Sure. Well, you, I don't have the essay in front of me that you're talking about, but you can see that in something like that, what he's doing is he's taking his own writing and he's putting it in Finnegan's Wake. But at the same time, he's taking Finnegan's Wake and putting it in his writing.
Yep.
So what he's doing is he's introducing a dynamic that is the question. He's introducing an atmosphere that is with between us and our spacesuit that we need to become conscious of. Let's say going back into the caveman mentality, but consciously. So as you often point out, it's doing Finnegan's Wake wakefully.
Yes. And there's no McLuhan in his writing. When he says I, blah, 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 and Gutmergalsi, that's the book talking. The Gutmergalsi is the book's interpretation and distortion of what's going on in the global theater. You see, there's no human writing and stating something there. The understanding media is taking the tradition of the book and it's categorizing cliche and its dictionary approach to things, and it says, okay, here's what me, Mr. Book, says about what's going on, and you read this dictionary of 33 parts called Understanding Media. That is the book's response to the electric simulation matrix, whatever you want to call it, in the 60s, the global theater. And
that's really good.
You like that?
You're saying, yeah, of course, because what you're doing is you're pointing out an underlying dialogue.
Yes.
And raising the whole question of, what is it to be an author? What is it to be a human subject? What is it to be a human being? And we exist in those questions without raising them.
Yeah, and there was this interview that the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, ABC, I think it was.
Yeah.
They did a show on McLuhan in the centenary in 2011, and Andrew was part of the negotiating with the TV people. We interviewed them on McLuhan on Maui, one of the producer ladies. And so watching, they had an old interview they had from 77, and there's McLuhan saying something in public to this crowd of strangers that he never said anywhere else. He said, the media are characters in Finnegan's Wake. It's really important. The media are the characters. Television kills telephony and Brothers Broil.
Mm-hmm.
You're watching the media, the content of Understanding Media become a drama, a wrestling match, and they're all engaging each other. That's Finnegan's Wake. But then McLuhan says, well, we can clarify this if we let Mr. Book say something. So Mr. Book comes along, or Mrs. Book, and puts everything in order for visual space, for visually biased humans. And that's Gutenberg Galaxy and Understanding Media, which is also an Apelian, another subtlety in the whole thing. So then McLuhan would, okay, so why do his books repeat themselves so often? Because they're targeting different aspects of the global theater. Like Take a Day is targeting politicians and economists. Laws of Media is targeting scientists. Cultures of Business is targeting advertising. War and Peace, maybe news. War and Peace in the Global Village. Each book is saying, no. Yeah, each book is the book's response to different parts of the corporate entities of the global theater. And that's the drama, the Broadway play that he's making. Doesn't have to be on Broadway. He is making a drama, a play, of all the things he does. So in the morning he goes on Robert Fulford's morning show and talks TV style. Then he goes and does a magazine article at noon hour, so the magazine gets to say something. And then he adds to his book that night that hasn't come out yet. And then he goes to a seminar and talks in person so speech can have a presentation. His Monday night seminars were the role of speech in the drama, you know, chemical body speech.
Right. So I would just add to that that if we say, why are his books repeating each other, or within a single book, why is there so much repetition,
yeah,
or why is there this error, or why do we not know where that quote came from, and all that sort of stuff. That all of those are book values.
But yes.
The whole question is, what is the value of the book, or what is even a book as a reality? What is it? What is the atmosphere of a book? What is it? What is a book or a book atmosphere all about anyway? McLuhan is trying to sort of feel himself around in those sorts of questions where he doesn't know the answer, but not knowing the answer is where we are today.
Right. So, what was interesting when you get to personally be around McLuhan, like in the Monday Night Seminars, and observe him, he would laugh in odd places. Okay? Laughs, chuckle, and you wouldn't know what the hell is he laughing at. Well, because he was so detached from his drama, it had to be the producer of it, the co-anesthetic position, he was at the center of it. All this drama is happening to people and they're totally unaware of it, of what he's performing. He's infiltrated decent society, got his PhD, and get away with a lot. And if you're really paying close attention to him, he is laughing obliquely. He's laughing at you, but you don't know what the joke is. You don't know what he's thinking of that he's presenting to you, and what he has created for you to be lost in. And so he will smile and smirk oddly. You probably weren't around him enough to see that. But he was like a parallel world ghost watching us. Do you see what I'm saying?
I agree with it. Yeah, I think so. But I think you're using the word produce. You were talking about McLuhan producing something, and then later you said he created something, but I don't think he was doing a production or a creation in the usual understanding of these things.
No, not as a commercial product or as a beginning.
Certainly not. But not a production or a creation in the sense of what artists usually are taken to do. It's something that I would say he let happen, and that's production in a new sense.
That's
to
right.
Let happen or to let be, and therefore his chuckling and his laughter would be odd if you were trying to figure out what he was doing in the sense of a usual production.
Yeah.
But of course, that wasn't what was going on. And his laughter, chuckling, had to do with what was going on, but not as a usual production.
Right. In a way, he was allowing so much to happen.
Right.
And the authorities, like the Governor General, you know, presented in Parliament that McLuhan needed to be censured. Remember that, late 69
no.
or so?
No.
They made an issue out of him. Because what was he doing? He's speaking, saying ideas. There was a lot of turbulence going on. He wasn't doing anything illegal. But they suspected this guy is being rude. He's invading our privacy in a way we don't understand. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's telling stuff about us that adults should not speak. You know, adults should not mention this stuff. Kids can't take it. There was that level of, it's almost like an environment of anarchy. So you would look at cartoons people would make of McLuhan. They were incredible. The distortion or the variety of images they had of McLuhan. They didn't know what he was. And that's because he was this weird ectoplasm oozing throughout society. Like his mind, if it had a thought, and he didn't necessarily utter it, but just having the thought, because we were in an intimate ESP kind of environment, so inside, he said in the Burroughs Review, we're inside each other's digestive system, inside each other's intestines. We're so intimately involved with each other that to think something actually might have a lot more impact than humans would understand. So that his thinking, he just had to think out the drama, dare to think. Oh, we've offed ourselves. We're not here anymore. We're now super angels. To think those thoughts was the production part of the guy, the director part.
Right, right. I like what you're saying there, but when you say we're super angels or something, it can't be, I think, that you're trying to make some kind of literal identification.
No.
I think you're using...
I'm using words because I got to use words, so...
Yeah.
They're way
yeah.
off. It's one. What? It's my fallacy. You think my fallacy is wrong. He admitted it right there.
Yeah, but the phrase way off is a great one.
Yeah.
That is
way off. We have recordings that Nelson had in class where he'll make asides like that. He'll talk about cliche archetypes. I might have got that backwards, but it didn't matter. He just thought, I might have got that backwards. And the students are trying to take notes to find out Gutenberg-wise what is what, right? Well, what is a cliche as opposed to archetype? And McLuhan just says, well, I might have got it backwards.
Yeah, yeah. And look how that relates to our talk about cavemen.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
We backwards, forwards, we have no idea of which direction we're going in, what direction we ought to go in, what a direction is. We have no idea about any of that sort of stuff. And
he lived it. Now, you're reminding me, he would sit there in his chair at the table, and then there would be a crowd there. But his hands would hang real loosely. And when he moved to get up, it was like he was waterlogged. He'd slowly stand up, dripping of something. You know what I mean? And he moved real slowly. Did you see any of that when you were around him?
When I was around him, he was sick.
Oh, okay.
You know, I've increasingly come to think that it must have been 1968. And
right.
He was very
recovering.
Irritable. Yeah, yeah. But he was very, very irritable. You know, in Project in 62, he talks about our nerves being outside us.
And, it happened to him.
That's how he came across to me.
Yeah. It happened after the brain surgery. You know, he's super sensitive. But maybe, I'm seeing him in the 70s, a few years later, regularly, weekly. And so really getting to know his body language. And that might have been witnessing the slower waterlogged McLuhan adjusting to these new sound intensities he had gotten used to.
Yeah.
Might have
I love the images you're using. This waterlogged
McLuhan
he
moved
makes a
like
lot
that.
Of sense to me. Yeah, yeah.
And every now and then he'd be sprightly though. He's Quadrophenia, man. He was an odd bird.
He was a good athlete when he was a kid.
Yeah, yeah. So we're making a lot out of this quote here. That's how good it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's tremendous stuff. And he talks about the Kennedy assassination, how the establishment, you know, he's conspiratorial. The establishment killed Kennedy because they tried to change the world. You don't do that under lesser conditions. You don't try to change the world. It's already been so changed. You got to find out what changes are happening, not impose your dinky little change, you know.
Yeah, so, absolutely, absolutely.
So they deserve to get killed. They're a mess. He says, you can't get away with that, he said. Something like that. you're not gonna pull that off. They're going to just kill you, get rid of you.
Yeah.
It's like caveman.
Which relates to Trump, right?
Yeah. Now, what's interesting is that Trump is still going. That's something to ponder. But back to what? This quote. Now, what is my little blue commentary?
Yeah.
What do I say about this tremendous quote? All right, so I say people will read this quote, and they won't know what the word media refers to because of them. The media is the programs that there we do. I brought that up, right? And you brought up we don't know what the word media refers to, so it's right there in my commentary. This is another challenge to your perception, said in a different way. McLuhan is referring to all the modern artists, Andy Warhol and others, who were into painting as well as TV shows and other media. Some of them, here's what I'm talking about, Richard Meltzer. Some of them thought wrestling and hockey were a new avant-garde. But McLuhan saying, nope, you scenesters have no clue what the avant-garde is. That's pretty good. You scenesters, right? That's what people were. They were hustlers and scenesters. They had to state their identity by oozing their mind. Oh, look, I'm paying attention to wrestling while you go to the latest John Cage production. You think you're sophisticated. No, sophisticated's over here watching wrestling. But even that was not the avant-garde. So
the word scenester, right?
Yeah.
People that are listening to this, it's the word is seen. As in a movie scene or the scene in a play, you have scene stirs, which I think is a great word. So is that your word?
I don't know. I think I got it from somewhere. Somebody said it. Maybe even McLuhan said it, but I don't think McLuhan said it. But, you know, I made it my own.
Yeah.
I used it.
Like,
nobody was using it.
The chapter we're reading is on the global theater.
Yeah.
And so everything is a scene.
Yes.
And everybody participating in the global theater are scenesters.
Yes.
That's what they're to play a role is to be a scenester.
That's right.
Right? It's to put on a mask.
And
I love that word.
Right. And the pollster guys would fight over which scene was the where it's at scene. So there was a constant fight over what the scene, the major scene is. And that screws up the economy. Money can't keep up with that. Money loses its control function.
Correct.
And so the media ecology that Wall Street did with the Federal Reserve wasn't working anymore because they knew economy, media ecology had taken over. Bigger environments that were changing
the
weather.
We're talking about 1970.
Yeah.
But the what you're describing is more true today.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, it's as McLuhan said over and over again, it's the same thing, only more.
Yeah. Let me repeat what I was about to say. I think you remember that line. Let me repeat what I was about to say. So Ian's always joking. Yeah, I was always joking about how what Bob used to say, he obviously wasn't saying, but what's getting real scary, Ion says, is that Bob's beginning to make sense. And all I'm doing is saying what I said 50 years ago, but it is becoming bigger now, what I'm saying in this article and these old quotes, which I said 40 years ago on the radio. It's now kind of that famous letter to Playboy where he says, Eliot's auditory imagination is ordinary awareness today. But Finnegan's wake is not ordinary awareness yet. Nobody's seen that. We're now fitting an ease. We're now getting close to what was not normal in where the auditory imagination, which was cliche awareness in 1970, has now become Finnegan's Wake, is the ordinary awareness. This guy was telling me, a guy in South Africa, he never talks about anything with his mother. She might have some interesting views in passing, but she called him up the other day. She's 84 years old, and she says, "Michael, it's happening. It's happening." That's all she could say. What she meant was whatever he used to say, quoting me, sounded crazy. Now she could see it happening in her South African environment, you know, in politics, whatever. So the average person is being forced to look at what McLuhan sees. Again, they're doing it by default. They don't know how they got there, but they can't stop seeing it.
Yeah. So you could say that what McLuhan was talking about was far out.
Yeah.
And anybody who's paying attention to Ukraine and to what Ukraine, the Ukraine conflict implicates for the entire world, for the whole order that we've lived, for the whole Federal Reserve System, for democracy, all of this sort of stuff is intensely in question. And the reporting of the Ukraine conflict is a gigantic attempt to deny what is actually happening, but not happening in the sense of what's going on in the war itself, but what's happening to us.
Yes.
What's happening to the war inside us.
Yes.
What is happening to all of the things that we think are going on in our lives and in our societies is suddenly in huge question. And the only real question is, do we understand the question or not?
Yeah, is there life before death? It's becoming a big question.
Exactly.
Not life after death. So I think of people out there in Kansas, they hear the news. Biden just gave $40 billion to Mr. Zelensky. And then there's no explanation of what it's going to be used for. And nothing's going on, whatever news you hear from there. So
correct.
Where did that go?
Where the $40 billion came from.
Where did it come from? Where did it go? And how about the poverty, you know, in the farm system as the food supply runs out? Why can't they throw a billion or two there? So the average American would look and say, well, we're not in America. They're not serving us. We aren't recognized. We're invisible. And they're servicing something else over there. You know, these are so blatant in the news that nobody can escape these questions or the questions that would come up from the story, from the item. So it's
absolutely.
So it's becoming what McLuhan said back in the 60s. He says the 20th century is a surrealistic canvas. We're in a surrealistic canvas.
Absolutely. Where a canvas, by definition, has a frame. But nobody knows what the frame is or how it operates or who the artist is or what the surrealism is all about, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's far more true today than in McLuhan's time, except what he was trying to talk about is something that doesn't become more true in time. It's what always is.
Yeah. Okay.
The big now, as you say.
The big now, right. So do we need to say any more about that, the blue quote? Where was I? I think I jumped ahead. Just a second. I say people will read that quote from Forces and not know what the word media means. Everybody thinks they know what media means, but the media has become insane. So what are we looking at? What happened to the frame that the word media gave us?
Right. But it's not just that the media has become insane. It's that the media are only possible because there is a deeper medium. And yes. So if you're going to understand media, you have to understand the deeper medium.
So and you come up with another word. That's why I come up with Android meme as the ground.
Okay, good. I like that idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what I was just going to say is everything has become deliteralized. You can't point to things and in order to identify them.
Yeah.
Deliteralization has to do with going beyond Gutenberg, because Gutenberg functions by literalizing. The start of Gutenberg is with letters, that is, with the literal. So going beyond Gutenberg, which is something that's always already happened, and it is always already in the big now, that literalization always has a complementary deliteralization. And what Western civilization did was they capitalized on our ability to forget or to overlook the deliteralization that was part of the literalization.
Yeah.
And now we have come to a fork in the road where we can no longer overlook the deliteralization. So we have to undergo the deliteralization as our way of becoming conscious of it. And that, you could say, that deliteralization can be seen as Finnegan's Wake. It can be seen as media disappearing as media. There's all sorts of ways of understanding that deliteralization, but that deliteralization is exactly the atmosphere that we were talking about earlier between the cosmonaut and the spacesuit.
Yeah. Okay, very good. Now, if you go to the next quote, which we've done 100 times, I'll just quickly run through it. As you listen to it, this quote doesn't get to where we're at today. This is a situation 50 years ago. And it is not applicable to today. So, just to say it, all technologies are collective unconscious. All art, science, and philosophy are anti-environmental controls that are ever merging into the environmental and losing their power to create awareness of environment. When arts fail to cope with the environment by being anti-environment, then there can be a shift to a rapid succession of innovations as ersatz anti-environments. So that's a tremendous statement in the 60s. Harold Rosenberg and Clement Greenberg and all the art critics, they should have studied that. That was the solving the crisis for art criticism. We were just quoting Harold Rosenberg fighting Hilton Kramer on the show today with Clinton. He had a nice little article by Rosenberg in 1976. And you could see it's like somebody overheard a McLuhan seminar and then tries to summarize what McLuhan said, and it's really weak and erroneous. That's how Rosenberg sounds. He's trying to point to this quote, but he doesn't know this quote, and he wouldn't know how to understand it if he read it. But this quote is clear to his – it explains what he's complained about in the art world better than what he's coming up with. So then I notice my commentary is what's interesting. I go, people think their heads have an unconscious in them, in their heads, in their skulls. But the environment is the unconscious. And he's talking about it in the previous quotation 4 years later, 1973, still trying to get people to understand him. He's saying the media are what you're not conscious of. That's the avant-garde. News is an anti-environment. People would look at news to ignore the good news of ads. They would get some dose of bad news that they're surviving. The news was an environment and an anti-environment, but all anti-environments by 1969 were fake anti-environments because nothing could be an anti-environment to the ongoing Niagara Falls of whatever the heck we were living in. There it is, question, what are we living in? Ersatz anti-environments is the first time fake news is being said. And McLuhan was on TV in 69, the time he was putting this out, saying all news is fake news, and the journalist couldn't take it. That's Warner Troyer. the journalist started rudely arguing with McLuhan right there on the TV show. McLuhan is being stubborn. He's saying, no, you're wrong. The journalist responds, no, I'm not. It ended up like that. The journalist says, no, you're wrong. And McLuhan retorts, no, you're wrong. And that's how the show ended. So it was that kind of stuff that started to give McLuhan a bad reputation, because people couldn't understand or even believe that he was on the right track. They just thought he was getting cranky or something, right?
Right. But remember that reputation is something manufactured.
Yeah.
So
he didn't care about that.
It's not that McLuhan did something and got a reputation. He did something that people didn't know how to deal with and didn't want to deal with, and therefore they manufactured a reputation that said that we don't have to deal with it.
Yeah. They'd make jokes like, McLuhan points out books are obsolete, but he writes books about it.
Yeah, how crazy. Yeah.
How crazy. So then I then bring in a quote by Frank Zingroni, which is from a collection of McLuhan articles called Essential McLuhan, Essential McLuhan Quotes, edited by Eric and Frank. Mm-hmm. So I have here, the selections in Part 4, says Frank and Eric, and that Part 4 is titled Culture and Art, Figures and Ground. So I say this, Frank writes, the selections in Part 4, Culture and Art, Figures and Grounds, exemplify McLuhan's erudite playfulness. He works a trope or two on Carl Jung and sheds new light on the notion of archetypal power. Who would have thought anyone could alter the idea of an archetype after the dominance of that area by Carl Jung? Art is very serious, high-powered play, and the intrusion of popular culture into the arena of art has been one of the most important new aspects of Western culture. So that's Frank. It's a little garbled, but he's trying to come up with some new questions. I juxtapose that to the scientific statement from page 31 of Counterblast, all technologies are collective unconscious, you know, where he goes past Jung. That's really profound. Well, what are we unconscious of? Well, it's not some inky dark area inside your brain. It's the fact you don't notice the color of your chair in the corner because you live with it every day. Your environment that you live in is cliche. And that's your unconscious. And that's a practical unconscious. You can get your fingers on that one. It's not some nebulous thing in your inside yourself somewhere in your interior landscape.
Mm-hmm. You know, but notice when you say get your fingers on it, you're implicating tactility.
Yes.
I
got to use tactility when I talk to you.
That's right. So you're not talking about anything that's literal. You're not talking about your actual fingers getting on an actual thing. You're talking about your unacknowledged fingers exercising tactility on unknown things.
Yeah, because, you know, they ask you, what's tactility, Bob? Well, it's not a sense. In other words, it's not knowable.
Correct. And this what I find interesting about these sorts of questions in the context of Trump is that you're saying, if I understand you correctly, you're saying that Trump brings into focus unknown questions.
Yes.
That are implicated in our environment that we're actually living every day and don't know that we're living, and of course, when we don't know it, we can't interrogate it and stuff. But Trump somehow, as an anti-environment, brings these questions up in a way that it's hard to evade.
Yes. First of all, he gets your attention because his grammar's so bad. he doesn't even finish his thoughts, you know? He just lets you fall into them.
That's good, right? Because I think what you're saying there is that he is using grammar in a new way.
Yes.
Right? Which is kind of a funny idea that because grammar is supposed to be some sort of ground rule that going against grammar is a sin. You can't go against grammar and use language properly.
Right.
And so here's somebody going against grammar in a way that raises questions about grammar.
Right. And I had a point there. He got so much attention. He still got a lot of attention. And how do you get attention? You have to involve the audience. You have to have them fill in what you're not completing, right? And he was a genius at presenting himself as an incomplete speaker in other ways, too. So everybody fell in to complete him, and that meant obsessive news coverage, and then they put him in the White House. So, and here's what he was. Yeah. Here's what he was. What'd you say?
No, I'm just laughing at the whole scene in which we're living as seamsters.
Right. So he applied Rumsfeld, the famous quote from Rumsfeld in news briefing, February 12, 2002. He said, reports that say that something hasn't happened are always interesting to me. We want to announce the news today, nothing happened. Reports that say that something hasn't happened are always interesting to me, Rumsfeld says, because as we know, there are no knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know. And if one looks throughout the history of our country and other free countries, it is the latter category that tends to be the difficult ones, the unknown unknowns. Somehow Trump actualized that. He became an unknown unknown, or he made it known or something, you know, by being it. But
that's an
incredible quote, eh? There are also unknown unknowns, the ones we don't know, we don't know. That's you've got the executives at the top of the visual space hierarchy talking McLuhan. That's McLuhan. Invisible environments. We know there are things that are not invisible. They're the figures. We also know there are the invisible environments or the known unknowns. We know that there are things we don't know because it's a new environment. We can't figure it out, and McLuhan helped us understand that. But there are things we do not know. There are things that McLuhan didn't talk about or we didn't know he talked about, and we're not sure if they're important. There are the unknown unknowns. There are the parallel invisible environments. The parallel timelines.
But notice that Rumsfeld was a guy that could have that kind of insight. He was a fellow Princetonian, and he had received at least some education there.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he could say stuff like that that made a great deal of sense. He could participate in huge wars.
Yeah.
Right?
And make huge mistakes.
Yeah, yeah. And how somebody could have that kind of thinking going along with that kind of action is very, very strange, but it's sort of where the modern world's at.
It's strange and revelatory.
It's exactly.
The conclusion presented to us. What do you call it? The transparency of everything becomes clear.
Yeah. How does that relate to the global theater that we're living in?
It's the Android meme. It's past the global theater. The global theater is a frame. The digital keeps melting away, miniaturizing, shrinking the global hologram or the global theater till it becomes unknown. It's too tiny.
Is it too tiny in the sense of exposing the entire universe?
Yeah, because it makes everybody, quote, a god. It inflates everybody. I mean, no one thought in 1965 that they would soon have access to every data there possible and be able to broadcast to billions of people. And all that goes on as daily texting life today, you know, within the Android meme and then tech body, where we ended up, nobody saw. Isaac Asimov, name any of these science fiction guys, it didn't come close. But what did come close was Finnegan's Wake, which was unreadable and a book of unknowns.
Yeah. So can we say that Finnegan's Wake is unknown squared?
Yeah.
And this the unknown unknowns is our environment, and the tech body is in quotation marks, because the is the question.
Yeah.
But so the tech body is the artist.
As psychopath, as serial killer.
Yeah. Like Rumsfeld.
Yes, like him. Like our leaders. All of them serial killers.
Yeah. But our leaders aren't leading anything, right? It's the environment that's leading everything, including the leaders.
Yeah, so the leaders, they thought that they had to present some leadership position. And so they only looked absurd because you couldn't present a position in a leaderless, decentralized big now. But then a leader shows up who can lead by being inarticulate and just engaging you and claiming and blatantly lie way beyond. I mean, they, you know, Washington Post comes up, well, he lied for 4 years 18,000 times, right? It's immeasurable what he did as they looked at his constant making a new reality, and they were trying to put Gutenberg matching on it, and it just looked like endless lying. He understood
right.
how to make the present.
But notice, when you say understood how to make the present, in a sense, he certainly did. But in another sense, he was totally incompetent.
That's right.
All of the people that he nominated to work with him were working against him.
But that created involvement. That made you feel part of the thing. You want you sympathize with him. You know, the people wanted to help him.
But whatever help means.
Nobody knew what the help was, but just say, yeah, he's our guy. He's the best president ever. It was almost like you have to have the word that makes the market perfect. The White House has to be perfect. So the whole population, or at least 50% of it, jumped in and helped Trump look good, because no human could look good anymore. Look at Biden. He's even worse. But and he purposely does nothing, right? He acts like a living zombie of the unknown, to hope to hold it. And some people claim he's doing a damn good job holding it together. But Trump is out there saying, no, Trump is the little kid saying the emperor's got no clothes. Trump, he says, Biden's doing me, and he's doing a terrible job at it. Get me back in there. I can do it better. I'll give you something you can get your grip on and how to help me. Because nobody can form a complete image of where we're going and where we are.
Right, right. So your description of Biden as living zombie of the unknown, that's a very good phrase. So how could you sum up Trump in a similar phrase?
He was a living actor. He wasn't a zombie. I always remember... he had this magic where some news guy was beside some soldiers, and Trump was out on the tarmac with a new kind of plane or something, a helicopter or something, and they fired a gun, a kind of gun salute, the thing, and Trump's in the distance. But you hear this female soldier say to this guy, he didn't even flinch. They noticed that the fucking guy, he was so... either out of touch with everything, that he appeared super skin, super protected, super aware. He was used to fighting out in the field. He didn't get thrown by gunshot. Look at what they were impressed. They noticed that. you know, the guns go off, and Trump is not even, he's either not registering it. Biden is the hidden ground of Trump. He's a zombie. But Trump looks alive. Trump is a stage before where he looks like he's conscious of what's going on. And they're very impressed. And so you'd see all the time, he'd go up to the airplane to go up the side steps, and there'd be a guy saluting him. And the guy's hat would fall off, blow off. Trump would go and get the hat. He did these little acts of generosity, of not being a hierarchical queen or king that wouldn't you had to bow to. He was there to help you on the simplest things, right? So he allows himself to go out there and experience the irritation of his ears being blown up by the gun salute, but he doesn't even flinch. I mean, do you get what I'm saying? That was one of the best things I remember, is these two soldiers saying, wow, he didn't even flinch. Like, everybody was watching him to support him, so they noticed things like that. He didn't flinch. That's astounding, right?
But at the same time, he flinched in regards to the Federal Reserve or in regards to the regulatory agencies. He flinched in exactly the same way that presidents had always done.
Right? Yes, he you know how he had the booming economy? He let the drug dealers come in and they wouldn't be taxed. And he got all their money that was all offshore. Like he went illegal. He did illegal things, or, you know, immoral things or something. He let the drug dealers be part of the economy. They didn't have to hide anymore. And that created a boom, so there was money to put blacks to work. And then the blacks were very impressed. Holy shit, this guy's giving us jobs, you know? So he's like a Mr. Magoo. He couldn't make a mistake, and yet everything he did was, quote, wrong in relation to tradition. You know, it's just so that's what we're trying to explain here, how the global theater becomes a global membrane, and everybody's dancing on the same spot, and nobody has a clue what that spot is, and yet they look for a leader. So you're going to get the gradations of leadership, you know, from Kennedy, he's so effective, you got to kill him. And then you get LBJ, he's ridiculous, but then you get Nixon, and Nixon is an obvious mafia lawyer, right? And he has a certain image. And then you have to flip that into Carter. And then Carter has to flip into a small-town guy, Reagan. Then Reagan has to flip into a slick guy, Bill Clinton, for the Internet 90s. And then Bill Clinton has to flip into a dumb zombie, George Bush Jr. And then that flips, incredibly into a black man as president. And then that flips into a zombie guy or whatever Trump is. And you know, Ian has said that Biden is the last president. Trump was not a president. That really created involvement. There's nobody at the center making the word that makes the market. You know what I mean? Which is the role of the White House, the word that makes the market. There's nobody doing it. So everybody had to help the market make a word. They had to help Trump. So an amazing, involving image. At the same time, everybody's worried that he's going to become a fascist authoritarian, that he's not. He's faking the democratic participatory mystique. That then gets into Quadrophenia, which is where we're at.
So let's relate that for a moment to global theater and the global membrane.
Yeah.
The global theater is a frame. Right, the proscenium arch.
Yes,
and the frame implicates what is beyond the frame.
Yeah, you can't frame it.
Yeah, so the proscenium arch is a satellite environment, and the satellites implicate what is beyond the satellites. So you at once have a frame with its definition that questions itself. So,
yes.
How do you see the global membrane as being somehow beyond that, or as
that is the one spot we're all in? Like right now, we could have 4 billion people listening to us, if you organize everybody, they get on their cell phones and tap in, right?
Yeah.
And we'd all be where? We'd be all in one spot which had no visual dimensions. We'd just all be there. And you might as well say we would be engaging in ESP. We'd all be inside each other. So that's the membrane, the one super angel spot we all exist in. And then you put a global theater around it, the frame, but then the frame becomes a tetrad in four parts. So that becomes a one. The global membrane is one, and the frame has become quadraphenic. It's four. So the number for the Quoker quadrant in my chart, which is the quadrant of the Android meme, is 14. One and four, two parallel operations, right? The frame has become quadraphenic, and the unity, the implosion, is the membrane, is one. Now, if we go back to McLuhan, he's number 22. He's A is to B, C is to D. He is the virtual reality with its ratios parallel to the earthly chemical body reality. So there's two twos there. It's a balanced symmetry. The oneness is the ground, but you don't see it. But then when you get to the Android meme, you see the oneness. That's the one part of 14, and four is the quadraphenia. And what is quadraphenia? That is the emotions of paranoia, schizophrenia, hysteria, panic, and ecstasy. Five expressions of extreme response by the dangling ganglia of the singularity one, the Android meme. I mean the global membrane. That's one.
How does quadraphenia have five parts?
The chart is 1960 to 1990. And if you look at the dates of the five parts, you see that the Dobbs quadrant at the bottom is 1960-1990. It's all the Dobbs quadrant. And then there's four aspects of it, which is the LaRouche, McLuhan, Thompson, Croker quadrant.
Uh-huh.
So they spin around. They're Orphic Baroque spirals that are circulating around the central spot we all dance on. And
so I was talking about, you named,
quadrants four and five. So Frank Sangroni pointed out that in alchemy, there's a battle between the alchemists who believe in a basic fourfold structure, and I think the Chinese have a fivefold structure. So it was four versus five. Now, the chart is visual space made explicit and extreme, because the Android meme is not visualizable. It doesn't look like the chart, but you put on the eye and you present the chart. This is what it looks like if you could look at it. And it's got to have the blurred part of it where four and five. So that's the irony. I talk about the quadrants, but if you notice, there's five of them. So the mixture of five and four is to bring in non-visual imprecision, the acoustic or tactile, to make it resonating. So it's an intentional misnaming of things.
That's the quantum physics element where the lack of precision is more precise than any precision.
Yeah, fuzzy logic. And the you'll notice each quadrant has a category for many disciplines. So each quadrant is a subatomic particle on the chart. I got
This is like a chemistry or
a cyclotron.
Of the big now.
Yeah, and I have at the top, I call it a cyclotron. But at the bottom, I say.
Are you saying cyclotron or psychotron?
No, cyclo, you know, the physics, CERN and that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. But cyclotron is a great name for the global theater, right? Or maybe the global theater / global membrane.
Yeah, C-Y-C-L-O, cyclotron, right? That's what you're saying.
But I'm saying psycho.
Oh, it has psycho embedded in there, yeah.
Cyclotron is a pretty good word for our condition.
That's a tech body. The tech body is the Android meme gone psychotic.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah,
right.
And I think
the cyclotron itself has a quadrophenia of meaning.
Yes, and I think McLuhan uses the word cyclotron somewheres at one point. He calls it the cyclotron, maybe cliche, interplaying with archetypes. Might have been a foreword to the paperback version of Culture is Our Business, you know, some obscure book like that, which reminds me.
It had two different introductions, one for the hardback and one for the paperback.
Yeah, that's right. And have you ever seen Volume 2 of his high school book, Voices of Literature?
Oh, I have Volume 2, but what I don't have is Volume 3. That's very obscure.
Well, I never heard of that.
I'll send you some information on that. Andrew McLuhan has Volume 3 of Voices of Literature and has quoted from its introduction. And I've tried to find a copy of Volume 3 of Voices of Literature for years, and I haven't been successful.
Yeah, I saw Volume 2 in the Royal Conservatory of Music in, you know, Bloor Street in Toronto, in their library, someplace like that. I was just in there, and there was a copy. It's the only time I ever saw it. I don't know how many there were made, and where's the used bookstores, where are they, but I didn't know there was three.
Yeah, well, the third volume was published years later, about 10 years later.
What's it called?
Volume 3 of Voices of Literature.
Wow.
Oh, it does have a subtitle, something about masks, I believe.
Yeah, roles, sounds, and masks.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. And that was an essay he did, but might have been for that book. Anyways, well, that's interesting. I'll have to look at my bibliography, Mark Stewart's bibliography, if there's three there. But I was always just
looking for that. Most bibliographies, there's only two. And at one time, it was denied that there was a Volume 3. And I personally thought there was no Volume 3. But now Andrew has actually quoted from it. And, I mean, it exists. Mm-hmm. But I've never seen it in any of the used book sites online.
So is this quoted in his Instagram or McLuhan Institute?
I think it was a McLuhan Institute. Maybe it was in a tweet,
because
he's a fairly active tweeter. And I don't pay any attention to Twitter, any of that, but I occasionally get emails out of the blue saying, you know, have you seen this tweet?
Mean people tell you?
No, it comes from Google, I think.
Oh.
Or maybe it comes from Twitter itself. I don't know.
Right.
I get emails and they say, here's a tweet from Andrew McLuhan. And the subject line is all I get from Google or Twitter. But it looks interesting and I click on it and... Then I get some sort of random information from the universe.
So where are we at? So you like the way I number it. McLuhan's 2-2, that's analog media. But digital media, Android Meme, is 1-4.
Mm-hmm.
And then
I like the way that you're listening to a fog of numerology.
Yes.
And you're saying, oh, look, this is interesting, right? Anybody who thinks that these correspond to sort of real things, numbers that, you know, are sitting on a desk somewhere, you know, is wrong. You're functioning as a radar system. That can bring into focus things that are floating in an environment that we don't know is there.
That's right.
That's right.
It's very clever what I do.
Well, except that clever has nothing to do with it.
That's right. No, clever has nothing to do with it. Yeah, I got to use errors when I talk to you. So the okay, so we're we did that. So are we getting to see what the global theater is versus the global membrane? Did we help move that along?
Yeah, a little bit. If I understand what you do with those things, you see each of them within the other.
Yep.
And what you're trying to talk about is the dynamic between the two.
Yeah.
And I guess the Android meme and the tech body represent constellations of the dynamic between them.
Yeah.
That's just my guess.
Yeah, that's good. So then I say, after explaining, you know, Zingroni, which is a, just that he recognizes that McLuhan, he's the only other guy who's noticing that McLuhan's creating a new meaning for the unconscious. He's going past Carl Jung. You know, who would have thought anyone could alter the idea of an archetype after the dominance of that area by Jung? That's a good thought, good question, but that's a way of showing McLuhan went past Jung. And so then I say, in my little blue part, Carl Jung popularized the word archetype, which meant some symbol in your mind that you dreamt, something in your unconscious, and that was the definition of archetype. McLuhan took on the Jung meme and came up with a different definition of archetype, which was technologies are the archetypes. McLuhan talks about all technologies are the archetypes of the social unconscious. Art is something that deals with our unconscious, and it's very serious, high-powered play. You've got classical art, capital A art, and its ancient anti-environmental unconsciousness. But popular culture today intrudes into the arena of art. It has been, he would say, one of the most disturbing disruptions of Western culture. I guess McLuhan said that somewhere. McLuhan's highlighting another angle, the archetypal power. Not many people knew that McLuhan had one-upped Jung. I have that excellent quotation by William Irwin Thompson where he runs through the different conceptual unconsciousnesses, Sigmund Freud, then Carl Jung, then Claude Lévi-Strauss, and Gregory Bateson, but he leaves out McLuhan. He should know better. Frank Zingroni, a longtime friend and colleague of Thompson, is smart enough to notice. Quote, McLuhan is going past Jung, and he's trying to talk about it. Zingroni marvels. Who would have thought anyone could alter the idea of an archetype after the dominance of that area by Jung? McLuhan did. So that's original to point this out. I don't think you've ever seen anybody else talk about the archetype of the unconscious this way. You may have thought it when you read it, but this is unique, what I'm saying, right? This has not been pointed out by McLuhan people, the updating of the unconscious.
I'm not. We'll have to talk some more about what you mean by what you just said. Let me just give a little historical background for people here. This isn't profound or anything. It's just history. In the 1940s, McLuhan was very, very influenced by Jung. When he got to Toronto, Fry and others were very taken with Jung and kind of exercised Jung in areas that Jung himself had not. But McLuhan, before he got to Toronto, was already very influenced by Jung. In the 1940s, beginning already in like 1943, let's say, and then all the way to 1950, McLuhan is trying to think through what the whole notion of archetype implicates. And eventually he realizes that cliche and archetype cannot be held apart or simply contrasted, that as he says here, popular culture begins to complicate the archetype. Well, how does it do that? Well, popular culture is cliche. And if popular culture can become archetype, cliche can become archetype, that means that figure and ground are reversible. And if figure and ground are reversible, that calls into question identity, it calls into question religion, it calls into question everything. It calls into question what a question is. So what's going on with Carl Jung and McLuhan is that by taking questions from Jung, questions that Jung in his own way posed, because archetypes for Jung are dominance. And so the question of the archetype in Jung is, what dominates us? What already imprints us from the get-go? But imprint is cliche. So what McLuhan takes over from Jung is a whole bunch of questions that eventually in 1950 bring McLuhan to question himself. And so the whole, from 1950 to 1980, we have three decades of McLuhan trying to think through what it is to be called into question personally, culturally and environmentally.
Yeah, and he would say, we have the questions. After 10, 15 years, they had made an inventory of questions. They had some.
Yeah, but amongst the questions they have is, what is a question?
Yeah.
So it's like, I forget the artwork of the guy where the artwork has him going upstairs and downstairs at the same time.
You mean an Escher kind of paint.
Yeah, exactly, an extra print. Yeah.
Okay, well, that was a great summary. We're well past your time. It's 10 after 6, so we'll end on that point. We'll come back to this quote and talk about archetype. That's the next serious terms I have that we need to
I enjoyed that, Bob. I think I understood a little bit better today where you're coming from your book, with your book, and that's the object of our exercise here.
Yeah.
So thank you for that.
Okay, I'm going to disconnect. You're going to say goodnight, and I'll stop the recording, and then I want to mention something to you off air, so to speak. Okay?
Okay.
So stay on the line,
sir,
after you say goodnight.
Yep. Goodnight, Bob.
Yeah, thanks a lot. That was very good.